Thank you. My name is Keith Lewis, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm just delighted to be here with you. It's very much like a homecoming for me. I lived in Birmingham for a couple of years in the 80s, and so flying into Birmingham and was sort of like, I used to fly in every week, make me crazy. I had a job that had me on airplanes all the time, and I'd fly in and out of Birmingham all the time, and lived down there for a couple of years, and so it was a lot like coming home. I really want to thank you so much for asking me to take part in this. It's always, you know, humbling to be asked to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous, but especially something that has the history that's here and the reverence for the program that's here. And I really want to thank Kim and John for picking me up, and we stopped and had lunch and had some great conversation. I really enjoyed it. I enjoy talking to Kim these months while we're getting ready for this weekend. And I'd also like to thank my wife, who isn't here, but at this very moment she's praying for me. She always prays when I speak. I told her I'd be talking about 8 hours this weekend, and she said I was going to be on my own most of the time. But she really does. We have a little room in our house that we've given to God. God gave us the house, so we give him a room, which seems fair somehow. And she goes in and closes the door and prays that... And I always ask her to pray that you not hear what I say, but you hear what God would have you hear. And they're usually different, especially in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a wonderful organization. I can't tell you how many times people have come up to me and said, you know, that story you told about such and such saved my life. I never told that story, you know. But they heard that story, and that's what matters. You know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, we just carry the message, and then you hear the message. And they're often not the same message, but it doesn't matter. God arranges all those things. And so I'm really, really delighted to be here. I'd like to ask, not to embarrass anyone, but is anybody here fairly new in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous? Great. I am so pleased you're here. And I want to congratulate you for being here. I could not have been around this many people when I was new. I'd have been hanging on the ceiling or something like that. I mean, I was very, very nervous and very quick when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And you're most welcome here. And if there's anything you don't understand, just grab somebody. What I'd like to do this weekend, with your permission, is to sort of drift through the steps. Okay? I'm not going to teach you about the steps, and I'm certainly not going to read to you from the books. I assume you have your own book, or if you don't, you can borrow one. Just kidding. And so I'm not going to read you from the book, but what I wanted to do was talk something about the principles of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous while going through the steps. And maybe share in a general way how I took them, or in some cases how I didn't take them, and what the results were. Before I get started, I want to mention something about Maggie. It's a great honor to be here with you. I was telling Maggie before dinner that we had a mutual friend. There was a man named Bob Brown, and Bob got sober in the Biscayne Room. And in the 70s, he moved to Washington, D.C., and he and I developed a friendship that can only happen in Alcoholics Anonymous. We were truly brothers, and Bob passed away a few years ago. And one of the stories I love, there's a clubhouse in the Washington, D.C. area out in Bethesda, and there was a lady there who sort of ran the place. And she came in, and Bob was doing something, and she began to chew him out. And Bob listened to her for about 30 seconds, and he said, just a minute. He said, if I can interrupt you just for a moment. He said, I just think it's fair to tell you that I got sober in the Biscayne Room, and Maggie used to chew me out. And the woman says, oh, hell, forget it. And that was the end of that. And true story, really a true story. I like to mention Bob because, like I say, Bob became one of my great friends, and I watched Bob Brown die of emphysema, and you would think a pretty horrible death, and it was quite the contrary. I, I saw a man who for 3 years couldn't even leave his home, and we started a meeting in his house, and he made every meeting, and he heard Fifth Steps every week, and 2 days before he died, he heard a man's Fifth Step. He constantly worked this program, and he learned that in Atlanta with Maggie. I remember one of our good friends had been diagnosed with brain cancer, and he could drive. And Bob, he would drive around and get newcomers and take them out, and Bob would prop himself up in bed and talk to them. And I never want to forget that picture as long as I live. It was sort of my version of the man in the bed. Only in this case, the man in the bed was the one that was doing the giving. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous on May the 13th, 1973, and I'm one of those fortunate people. From the time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous until now, I have not had to take a drink. So it's something over 26 years. And I'm convinced that that's the case because I had a very severe case of alcoholism. And I didn't have a light case. And even when I arrived here, I had a very, very, very serious case of alcoholism. I also have to tell you that I'm one of those people who came to Alcoholics Anonymous by way of a treatment center. Now, some people don't like that, but I mean, that's how it happened for me. I was living in a basement of a house in the Skid Row section of Washington, D.C. of 29 years of age. My wife had requested that I leave our apartment, and the judge requested I leave the state of Maryland. So between the two of them, I got the message, and I went to where I needed to go, which was a basement of a house in Washington, D.C., and that's where the miracle happened for me. And the miracle was I drank all I could drink, and I couldn't drink anymore. May the 13th, 1973, I went into what passed for a bathroom, and I had one idea in mind, and that one idea was to die. And I would have thought that suicide was a big deal, but it's really not a big deal. For an alcoholic, suicide's just the next thing. That's all, it's just the next thing. In 12 years before this, in July of 1961, I was this 17-year-old, 113-pound kid who left a little town in Martins Ferry, Ohio, took a bus from Wheeling, West Virginia to Pittsburgh, which is about 60 miles away. It's the second longest trip I'd ever been on. Once I went to Cleveland, and I was 13 years old, and I'd gone up there to join the Marine Corps. Now, I knew nothing about the Marine Corps. The only thing I knew was they occasionally took some people to a swamp in South Carolina and drowned them. That's the only thing I knew about the Marine Corps. And I was also knew I couldn't ask. I was always someone who knew he couldn't ask. And I also knew that everybody understood the big picture, except me. It was sort of like one day God put everybody in a big room and he said, I'm going to explain this once, pay attention. And he told everybody about how to grow up and how to be a real man and told them all about sex and about politics, told them about God and all that stuff. And I was in the bathroom. And the feeling I had my whole life was that everybody understood but me. And so my job was to go through life and act as though I understood the big picture. And the truth was I had no earthly idea of what was going on. I even joined the Marine Corps because I didn't know what I wanted to do when I graduated from high school. And my thought was everybody knew what they wanted to do because you all seemed so sure of yourselves. So I was convinced I was the only guy who was lost. And my thought was if I go away, they won't know that I don't know what it is I'm supposed to be doing. They'll think I'm doing it. So I had to go away. And back then, the way you went away was you either went to college, and there wasn't great danger of that, or to the military, because all the men went in the military. It wasn't if, it was where and when. And so I went up to Pittsburgh and I joined the Marine Corps. And that night, in May of 1961, my life changed. And it changed in a way that was to map the course of my life. I had that profound awakening that happens to alcoholics the first time most of us get an opportunity to drink as much as we want to drink. And I never want to forget it. There were three guys from Pittsburgh who had joined the same time I did, and our train was leaving that night. It was leaving at midnight. It was about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and we went over to a little bar And I had no idea what we were going to do, but I just followed them over there, because that's what I did. I followed people around. And we went over and sat down. I like to say that I walked into this place, and it was filled with real men, you know, the kind that, you know, spit on the floor and have tattoos, and they know all those words. And you know, all of them had real women with them. You know, real women hang around with real men, and guys like me get what's left. And I remember sitting at the table with these guys, and the bartender came over. He was a real man, and he said, "What do you want?" And I thought, "Oh my God, a quiz!" And I always thought that when you least expected it, somebody was going to say, "Take out a blank sheet of paper and put your name in the upper left-hand corner." They're going to ask a lot of questions, none of which I had studied. You know, I studied a lot. I just never studied the right stuff, and I did not answer a question like, "What do you want?" So I waited, and these guys ordered a beer, so I did too, And, you know, years later, a psychologist would scratch his chin and say to me, "Why do you think you began to drink in the first place?" Now, I knew that had to be an important question. So I remember I went home, and I got a fifth of scotch, and I went down by the stream all by myself, and I drank that whole fifth trying to figure out why I drank in the first place. And then I went down to Jim and Mac's Sunnybrook Farm, which was a hillbilly bar near where I lived. And I was sitting there, and I said to the guy next to me, "Tell me, why'd you drink in the first place?" He said, "Shut up." I said, "All right, I was just wondering, you know." And you know, I could never figure out why I drank, so I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll tell you why I drank in the first place. I'm 17 years old. I weigh 113 pounds. You know, I've never been away from home. I have no earthly idea what's going on in the world. And I'm in a bar with three other guys, all of whom order a beer. And I just didn't have the intestinal fortitude to order a sarsaparilla. That's why I drank in the first place. And, of course, for an alcoholic, it's not important why we drink, is it? What's important is what happens to us when we drink. And what happened to me was I had a profound spiritual awakening. And that's the only way I can describe it. Because what it did was my reality was displaced. After somewhere between a second and a third drink, my life changed in a way that was to dictate the rest of my life. And that's a profound experience. And I remember I stood up. I didn't want to stand up. I just stood up. And I looked, and my whole world was different. The floor was 6 feet, 4 inches below me. And my right shoulder was out there, and my left shoulder, and the muscles were rippling through my body, you know. And that mind that had been filled with fear and terror and everything, just like, boom, just like that. It was crystal clear. And I remember thinking, of course, it's so simple. Why didn't I see it before? I mean, life is so simple. And I understood the big picture. And then I looked around that place, and my heart broke, because that place was filled with a bunch of pathetic, snivelling little men. You know, and all of them had women with them, with their hungry eyes looking at me. You know how they do it. And it was incredible. It was one of the most incredible experiences I ever had in my life. And I spent the rest of the evening going from table to table answering questions. You know? I mean, here I am. I'm a guy who doesn't know anything. I'm as dumb as a tabletop. And a half hour later, I'm the most brilliant guy who ever lived. You know? Now, my sponsor is Tom I. from Aberdeen, North Carolina. Now, Tom told me, he said, "You know, you weren't yet alcoholic. You could have quit drinking." I said, "Tom, who on earth would have wanted to? I mean, that's the greatest I ever felt in my life." And, I mean, it was spectacular. I was answering questions they didn't even ask. You know? And it seemed to me, it's about 11 o'clock and we had to go catch the train, and it seems to me, now this may not be entirely accurate, but this is my recollection, okay? It seems to me they were saying, "Please don't go, we've just discovered you." That's what it seems, you know? And, I mean, it was an amazing discovery for me. And I never knew life could be like that. And I went, I got on the train. I assume I got on the train. And I think it's reasonable to assume that, because I woke up on the train the next morning. And that was one of many assumptions I was to make over the next 12 years. But I woke up, and I was lying on the floor of the Pullman coach that the Marine Corps had provided for me. And it's hard to believe, but someone had wet the floor I was lying on. I know it's hard to believe, but they had. And whoever it was had also wet me. And a terrible thing had happened. I was 300 miles from home, and again, I was 17 years old, and I weighed 113 pounds. And I didn't know anything. It was just amazing. And I changed my clothes and got off the train, and the guys were waiting for me. And they said, "What do you want to do?" And I knew what I wanted to do. I wanted to find some of what I had had the night before that changed my life. And so we went to a place called the Monocle, and we began to drink. And, and, uh, and got on a train. I was drunk. I got on a train in Washington. And back then, when the train crossed the line in North Carolina, they closed a club car. And I was screaming my objection, my hatred for the state of North Carolina, until we got to South Carolina, and they opened a club car back up. And I fell off the train in a place called Yamasee, South Carolina. Someone moved a bottom step or something. I fell across the next set of railroad tracks, and there was a very rude man, Bob, that they had sent down there to talk to us, to welcome us. And he was hurling obscenities at myself and the other young men who had gone down there to die for their country. I tried to explain to this cretin that he'd probably get a lot further with us if he treated us with a little respect. You know, he never seemed to be able to grasp exactly what it was I was trying to say. He's a very limited man, and they say you can learn from every experience. And I'll tell you what I learned from that experience. I learned that you can do a lot of push-ups drunk. That's what I learned from that experience. You know, and I'll tell you, I hope you never have to use this information, but you can also do push-ups and throw up at the same time. You know. And I did a lot of that. And then, you know, and they said there's something to be grateful for. I'm grateful we weren't doing sit-ups. That's what I'm grateful for. And I was launched into the Marine Corps. But it had happened to me. That thing had happened, you know. It had happened. And I tell you, I really loved the Marine Corps. And I often wondered why. I mean, you know, you got to be in line for the second step if you love Paris Island. But I just loved it, you know. And I wondered why, and you know, I'd sober a number of years, and I finally figured out why I liked Paris Island. It was because I had spent the first 17 years of my life guessing at what my job description was. I don't know if anybody can relate to this, but I spent my whole life guessing at what it was I was supposed to do and be and all that stuff, you know. And the Marine Corps had a very, very clear idea what it was they wanted you to do, and they weren't a bit hesitant about sharing it with you, you know. So I think that's why I loved it. And, you know, I packed on about 30 pounds, and I grew a few inches, and I won the Dress Blues Award, an Outstanding Man's Award off of Paris Island. I got meritorious promotion. And I was going to spend the rest of my life in the Marine Corps. I was home. You know, next to the nuns, it was easy. And I really was going to spend the rest of my life there. There's one problem, and it's a small problem, and the problem was I was alcoholic. That's the problem. And what being alcoholic means to me is that I will fall in love with a way of life. You know, the most enthusiastic people in the world are members of Alcoholics Anonymous. They really are. I mean, just enthusiastic people. And I was enthusiastic drunk, you know. I mean, I'd find a way of life, and I'd love it, and I'd throw myself into it 110%, and I'd go to great lengths and everything. And then I would begin to violate every principle associated with that way of life. See, because first step says I'm powerless over alcohol, my life had become unmanageable. What that means to me is that I'm a guy who, if he takes a drink, he can never predict what's going to happen. But I know that whatever happens is going to have something to do with the deterioration of my value system. You know, I began drinking in 1961. You know, in 1962, I was less the man I wanted to be than I had been in 1961. And in 1963, I'd violated more principles associated with being a Marine and a human being than I had in 1962. And that's the horror to me of alcoholism. Every year, I was less the man I wanted to be than I'd been the year before. I'd violated more principles. And that's, to me, the first step. It says that I become everything that I swear I never want to be. And the only defense I had was to blame the Marine Corps. And that's what I did. I after 4 years, I was offered a commission. I worked hard for that. I had a few meritorious promotions. I was offered an appointment to go to Quantico to go to Officers Candidate School, and I turned it down because I knew that the Marine Corps was making me drink funny. In 1965, we went did a little thing down in Santo Domingo, and I was blessed with excellent night vision, and they would test us for that, and I was an NCO, and every other night I would lead a patrol into town, and we'd often take fire and things, and from snipers and things, and in the night that I wasn't leading a patrol, I'd drink. And one morning I woke up, and I was fully clothed, and I had my 45 on, the slide, or the hammer was to the rear, there was a round in the chamber, and there were three rounds missing out of the magazine. It isn't normally the way I slept. And someone was waking me up, and they said, the captain wants to see you, so that you can, you know, make a report of what happened last night. And I had no earthly idea what happened last night. Well, what had happened was, evidently, the other man who usually led patrols every other night was sick. And so after I had consumed a couple of bottles of local fruit, rum, I got up, got dressed, led a patrol, a man, into a combat zone, took fire. By the grace of God, nobody was hit. And went back and lay down in my bed and went to sleep. And I don't remember any of it. And it terrified me. And they wanted me to explain what happened. And I, you know how we dance. And I said, well, I said, I'll tell you, it's hard for me to remember. I mean, everything happened so fast. I'm thinking, really? And so, you know, I had to go around and sort of get the story from the guys. And to make out a report. And I knew then that my problem was the Marine Corps. It was an abnormal way to live, and it made me drink funny. And I got out, and you know what happened, of course. I went into a steel mill, and that's an abnormal way to live, and it made me drink funny. So I left there, and I went to work in a theologian, a Jesuit theologian. It was like this place, you know. 130 guys studying to be priests are already priests, right? And I used to go to their graveyard, too. I used to go over there and drink, carry on conversations with the headstones and things like that. I mean, just crazy stuff. And of course, I left there. Just one hand. And now I got married. And you know, being married will make you drink funny. And you know how it is. And we had a couple of children on and on. And I'll share that with you as we go along. But the point is that I was in the throes of something that was dictating the course of my life. And I had no earthly idea what was happening to me. I didn't know Alcoholics Anonymous existed. I heard that at one time there was an organization back in the 30s or something called Alcoholics Anonymous, but it was a religious organization, and they had broken up because you no longer needed religion. I mean, you know, I didn't need a religion. I had an education. And only fools would, you know, worry about religion and all that sort of self-centered insanity that happens to us. But what I really want to remember about alcoholism was May the 13th, 1973, and I went into that bathroom to die. Okay, I was completely powerless. My life was totally unmanageable. Everything I'd ever wanted or worked for was gone. I was morally, physically, and financially bankrupt. I wasn't permitted to see my children. I mean, everything was gone. I've been drinking in a zoo. Mark reminded me of that. I used to drink in a zoo. I don't think there's any zoo drinkers here, but I hope nobody drinks again. But if you do, I'd like to recommend a zoo. You know, you're gonna end up there anyway. You might as well go. And I used to drink in a national zoo. And I'll tell you how I did it in case you're interested. I used to get a Tupperware glass. And I'd fill it up with whatever I had, you know, a 20-ounce glass, and I'd put an ice cube in it so I wouldn't be an alcoholic. Now, if you use ice, you can't be an alcoholic. And then I'd put the lid on it and burp it. You know how you do. And I went down to the zoo. And there's a lot of places to drink in the zoo. The best place is the Ape House. I didn't bother anybody, so they didn't bother me. The old Ape House, they had bleachers, and you could sit on the bleachers and look at the apes. And I'd go to the very end, and I'd go up to the top so that I wouldn't bother anybody. And I was across from the cage where they had an orangutan. Now, you know, you could, you know, pick your favorite ape. Mine was the orangutan. It seemed to have a lot more personality. And what was really nice about it was excited to see me. And I must tell you, you know, no one had been excited to see me in a little while. It would jump up and down and things, and I'd wave. You go to a place, you get to know everybody. Somebody asked me if it was a male or a female. You know, it's hard to tell when an orangutan. It didn't matter because I was impotent by this time anyway. But I used to sit there, and this orangutan was great. I mean, he'd do all the stuff, or she, whatever, would do all the stuff I always wanted to do. And I remember one day a family came in, you know, odd bunch, a man, a woman, two children. And, I mean, it's just a strange-looking thing. And, And they came in, and this orangutan sort of looked at me and had that glint in his eye, you know. And they were standing there looking and everything, and it settled down, and it picked up a whole pile of droppings and pelted the whole family. And I jumped right on, you know, and then the orangutan looked at me in disgust and walked to the edge of the cave, and I began to curse it because, you know, rejection's nothing, something I've never been very good with. And so the keeper threw me out. He told me, he said, get out of here. He said, I don't mind you drunks hanging around here. He said, but, you know, we have families coming in here, and you can't be talking like that. And I said to him, sir, I'll never be back. And I wasn't. I mean, I had some pride, you know. And I kind of considered that the end of my social drinking, because I then went back to this place I was staying in the basement of a house, and I went to where I needed to go, and it came down on me on May the 13th, 1973, and I went in there to die. And you know, I used to think suicide would be a big deal. I really didn't understand suicide, but I understand suicide now for the alcoholic. For the alcoholic, suicide's just the next thing. I'd spent 13 or 12 years trying to get back to Pittsburgh that night in Pittsburgh. It was the greatest night of my life. And I spent the next 12 years trying to get back to Pittsburgh. And no price was too great to pay to go to Pittsburgh. It's that simple. You know, and one day, you know, I went into the NCO club and I said, give me a double scotch on a rock. So I said, how much will that be? He said, 60 cents in your military career. I thought, well, that's about right, and I gladly paid it. And one day I went in for a bottle of gin, and the man in the liquor store told me, he said, that'll be $6.75 in your wife and your two daughters. And I thought, that's about right, and I paid it. I went to get some wine or something, and the guy said, well, you know, that'll be 75 cents in your life. And it seemed right. I mean, it really seemed right. It was just the next thing. And I had a bunch of pills in my medicine cabinet. I worked in hospitals, as did my estranged wife. And then they give you all the pills you wanted, you know, but I never took them. I was always afraid of them. Some of you think that's the saddest story you ever heard, but I just never took them. And so I had a medicine cabinet full, and I went in to take them all. And something happened to me, and it took me a number of years to understand this. And sometime, if you're interested this weekend, I'll be glad to share it with you. But I heard a woman spoke to me. And I said, I'm 29 years old, at least it'll be over. And a woman spoke to me, and I didn't like women. I married one, I gave them a chance, but I just didn't like them. So the fact that I heard a woman always mystified me. And this woman's voice told me not to kill myself. And it was just like, boom. All of a sudden, my mind was crystal clear, and I remember that my estranged wife had given me a phone number, two phone numbers, and I ran in, and I pulled a drawer out, and I fell on the floor, and I found a phone number, and I called it. And that's how I understood the first step, because the woman on the other end of the phone had a British accent. Now, I don't know why, but there was something very soothing about the fact that this woman had a British accent. Now, we went to war with these people a couple hundred years ago, so I don't know why I trust them. But I did. It was just something very soothing about it. And it's like she knew what she was talking about, you know, because she had a British accent. And she did, because she knew how to talk to me. It was a treatment center, and she was a recovering alcoholic, and she talked to me, and she knew I was suicidal. And she asked me for my phone number. She said, I'll call you back in a minute. Well, I know now that she wanted to know how to tell the police to get a hold of me. I was that suicidal, and she knew it. And she called me back, and she said, how can I help you? And I said, if you don't help me, I think I'm going to die. Now, I didn't know I was alcoholic, but God gave me a gift, okay? And when I hung up that phone, I looked, and there was almost a full bottle of scotch on a draining board. Now, you got to know, I know nothing about alcoholism, and I know nothing about Alcoholics Anonymous, but I knew this. If I took one drink of alcohol, I would die. But more importantly, knowing I would die would never keep me from drinking. I knew that I had an illness that I could never be frightened into being sober. And I know that's true because I worked in a teaching hospital, and in this hospital you could go to, they would list the autopsies, you know, and what people died of, sort of like coming attractions. And if you were interested in something, you know, you could sign up and you could scrub in. And so when sometimes they'd have, you know, some old guy, you know, 40, 41 years old, some, you know, had died of acute chronic alcoholism, and I'd scrub into this post, and I'd watch, oh, it's an awful thing. I'd see the liver and the brain, oh, it's just awful. And I'd, you know, I'd watch as much as I could watch, and I'd leave there, and I'd go down to Clyde's or Chadwick's. I'd go to Chadwick's and say, "Benny, you better give me a double. You'll never guess what I just saw." And he said, "You always get a double." I said, "Well, make it a triple." So he'd give me a triple martini, and I'd be, and the rest of the guys at the bar would say, "What did you see?" And I'd explain to them what I just saw, but the brain and the liver and all that stuff, you know. And they'd say, "My God, you better give us a triple too, Benny." And we'd sit there, and I'd sit there till midnight drinking, and we'd discuss how can someone do this to themselves. And we concluded that there's some people just don't like themselves, just don't have any respect for themselves. And so I knew that I could never be frightened into not drinking. So, and that's important information, and that to me is a critical part of the first step. Yeah, I knew that I would drink again. Okay, and I'll tell you how I envisioned the first step. And this is how I could, I had to make pictures in my head, and this is a picture I made. May the 13th, 1973, I had my last drink up until today, by the grace of God, okay? Now, that's a very important date. You know, I mean, 1973, May 13th, 1970, is a big date in our house. You know, my lovely wife, cross stitches, okay? And that date is cross stitch on everything. I mean, you know, if you sat in my house, she'd cross-stitch it on you. I mean, that is a big day in our house. And yet, that's not the drink that's important. The drink that's important, and I want you to hear this, the drink that's important is the drink I must take. See, being alcoholic means I must drink again, unless there's a miracle. And you're it. You're it. Okay? And I tell you how I see it. In the beginning, that drink was about 5 minutes ahead of me. Remember that? There were times, there were days I could smell it. You know, I go, "There's scotch around here somewhere." You know, I'd be walking down the street, "Who's drinking martinis?" I mean, I just, you know, I could, I mean, it was that close to me. It was so close I could smell it. And then gradually, going to meetings, talking to people, going to coffee, things like that, I began to push the drink further and further ahead of me. And then pretty soon it was a day ahead of me, you know, and then maybe a week, and then maybe a month, you know. In a couple of years, it'd be out there like 3 months, you know. And then I'd say, "I think I'll seek some balance." When an alcoholic begins to seek balance, what they're doing is looking for a good way to cut back on meetings, okay? And seeking balance for an alcoholic usually means seeking sex. Just the thought, you know. And so I'd begin to seek balance. Now, what happened to me in those times is I'd stop doing a lot of things I was doing, and I'd begin to gain on that drink. I'd begin to catch up to that drink. Now, if I ever catch up to that drink, I'll drink it, because you see, I'm powerless over alcohol. Now, I've been around other people's drinks. I mean, I was on a plane today, and there were people there. You know, that, I'm not interested in their drinks. But there's a drink out there that's my drink. And if I catch up to it, I'll drink it. And the reason I'll drink it is because I'm powerless over alcohol. Okay? And it's there. Now, I do a lot of 12-step work. I go to hospitals and jails and all sorts of things on 12-step calls. And I can't tell you, hundreds of people have said to me in a hospital, "I don't know what happened." I said, "I know what happened. What happened was you caught up to the drink with your name in it, on it, you know. And if you catch up to it, you'll drink it." By the grace of God, I've never had to catch up to it. I've been close. I've been awfully close. You know, I go in those phases where I become an expert, you know, and I go to meetings late, and then I begin to criticize people. All right, I know what she's going to say. She always says the same thing. That's all she ever says. I wish she'd read a different book. Maybe she'd get a different, you know, and on and on and on. And what that means is I'm catching up to my drink. And so that's, to me, what the first step is all about. It's being powerless over alcohol and having, and that my life is unmanageable, okay? And that's critical. Critical to me to know that. It's absolutely critical. And you know, the discovery I made back then is true today. If I take one drink of alcohol, I'll die. And no one I'll die will never keep me from taking it. That's why I'm an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's why I have a sponsor that I talk to. And I don't just have a sponsor. I mean, I have a sponsor I talk to. And we sit down and I bring him, he says, "Let's get current." And I sit down and we get current. And he asked me just really pushy, obnoxious, personal questions. Things like, "What were your motives?" And I'll say, "They were mine." and, and, And I sponsor guys. I sponsor a lot of guys. I'm a lucky man to sponsor the men I sponsor. And I sponsor a lot of them. And I sponsor them in prison. And I sponsor them by letter. And I sponsor them all sorts of ways. Okay? Because if I take a drink, I'll die. And knowing I'll die will never keep me from taking a drink. The only thing that will keep me from taking a drink is something that happened in 1935. A miracle happened in 1935, and I have the option of getting involved in that miracle. It's not my miracle. It's our miracle. And I can get in if I want. And that's the only thing I know that will keep me from drinking. The only thing I know. Now, other people may have some other plans. I don't have that plan because I'm a real alcoholic, and that means I'm powerless over alcohol. Okay? And if you're thinking that that means that if you take a drink, you can't predict your behavior, that's true. But it also means that left to my own devices, I must drink again. And that's a critical piece of information. That's the piece of information that I tended to forget the first few years I was sober. You know, the first few years I was sober, I was cursed with success. I don't know if anybody's had this experience. But I hit the road running, and I loved Alcoholics Anonymous from the very beginning. And from the very early on, I discovered something. Okay, I discovered that something outside of me could help me. The second step says the power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And we came to believe that it's a process. And let me, if I may, let me take just a minute and explain that, and then we'll take a break, okay? My second daughter was born. Her name's Kimberly. And Kelly was my first daughter, and Kelly had the good sense to be born at about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, so I was sober. Kimberly, on the other hand, decided not only to come at night, but to come about 3 months early. And I was doing what, you know, I think you ought to be able to do in your house. I was watching the test pattern on a TV. And some of you young people don't know what a test pattern is, but... It used to be that that when you drank, all the channels would go off the television, all three of them, and it, you know, you'd hear the national anthem, and if you could stand up, you'd stand up, because after all, I am a former Marine, and then they have these jets fly over, and I'd cry because I always cried it when they played the national anthem, and when they had, you know, supermarket openings and most everything else, but and then. I would proceed to watch the test pattern. Now, you know, it sounds boring, but, you know, you can vary it. You can lay down and watch it. You can stand up and watch it. And I'm watching a test pattern on the floor, and I was in my underwear, and it's a very private thing to be watching the test pattern. And my wife decided it was time to have the baby, and she couldn't waken me. I worked hard. And so she had thrown water on me, which meant I was wet. And then because she panicked and she hated me, she invited the neighbors over. And when I opened my eyes, the neighbors were standing there watching me watch the test pattern in my underwear. I was wet. And I quickly explained to them that she must have thrown something on me, because I'm not the kind of guy who would wet himself watching the test pattern. And they didn't seem to care. But, you know, I got up and somehow I got dressed and I got my wife in a car and I sped across town and I went to the hospital where I worked and it must have been mortifying for my wife, because I demanded that they take care of her, which was a joke, because I was the least considered person in the world, but I demanded that she was my wife and they take care of her. And the baby was born, and she weighed about 1 3/4 pounds or something like that. And I got home. I just got home, and I just fell into bed, and the phone rang, and my wife was crying, and she said, the baby has hyaline membrane disease, and they don't think she's going to live, and would you come back? And I remember I was just enraged. You know, I don't know how else to explain. I was just angry. And I showered, and I dressed, and I went back to the hospital, and it began an odyssey that just amazing to me. It's a very critical time with these kids. And 3 days before she was born, the hospital I worked at, Georgetown University, had ordered and received an experimental machine, very common now, called a negative respirator, but this is the first one they had. And it was put together the day before she was born. And the day she was born, the chief resident had gone to high school with me back in Ohio. And Mary Kate said to me, "Keith, we'd like to put your daughter on the respirator." She said, "We don't think she'll live. I'm sorry. But, and if she does live, we think she'll be retarded. But we would like to try." And the reason they wanted me to agree to it was I knew I worked there and I wouldn't sue them, you know. And so I told them to do whatever they thought they could do. And then I never want to forget this, because the next few days I discovered what had happened to me. And I discovered, our friend Bob Brown used to say, "I'm not the man I used to be, and I never was." And I sat in an office. We had an office that we used. It was across from the neonatal nursery. And I sat there at night, and I kept the door slightly ajar and the lights off so no one would know I was there. And I just watched this little thing fight for every breath. And these little infants, when they breathe, they retract, and they actually lift off the mattress. And she was fighting for every breath of life. And I knew what my father would have done. My father was father of 11 children, and he knew how to be a father, and he knew how to be a husband, and I knew what he'd do. He'd be in there, and he'd have his arm around his wife, and he would be telling her, "We can do this together," and all that, and I couldn't do that. And I remember the night that my wife, she'd walk up and down the hall like she had a 1,000-yard stare, and her husband was 10 yards away and wouldn't open the door and go out and take her in his arms. Because it was just, I couldn't. I don't know how to explain it, I just couldn't. There was just nothing there anymore. And I remember the night at 72 hours when it's very, very critical, and she went in and baptized our baby because they didn't believe she'd live through the night. And I ran down to the chapel. They had a chapel, and I hadn't been in it, and I hadn't been to church in quite a while. And alcoholism is a spiritual illness, and it certainly killed any spiritual life I had. And I went down there, and I was desperate, and I went into this little chapel. And I grew up in a Catholic church, and the tabernacle was a special place to us. And even when I was a little kid, I'd go playing ball. I'd run through the church, and I'd say, "Hi, Jesus, I'm going to go play ball. You can come if you want." And even as a little kid, I just loved the tabernacle. I never went by the church that I didn't go in and visit. And I went in that night, and I got on my knees in front of the tabernacle, and I begged God to let my little girl live. And I said, "If you'll let her live, I'll do anything. If you'll let her live, I'll stop drinking." And I was drunk in 12 hours. I drank when I thought drinking would kill my baby. Am I powerless over alcohol? My goodness, yes. You know, there's a great philosopher named Blaise Pascal, Frenchman. And he said God created man in his own image, and unfortunately man returned a favor. And I had created a God that would kill a little kid because her dad was sick. And that's how spiritually ill I was. And then I walk into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and a perfect stranger standing at the door. Perfect stranger. I never saw this guy before in my life. And he had that smile on his face, you know. He said to me, "You're new, aren't you?" And I thought, oh my God, he's psychic. I mean, how's he know? And then he shook my hand, you know, the way they do in Alcoholics Anonymous, with both hands. And then he looked me in the eye, which I always thought was kind of pushy, you know, kind of obnoxious. But he looked me in the eye, and one of those guys. And he said to me, "You know, son," he said, "if you keep coming here, you never have to drink again." And I wanted to scream at him, "You don't know me. I'm a guy who drinks when he thinks drinking will kill his little girl." But he did know me, because he was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he knew that a power greater than me could restore me to sanity. He knew that you could do for me, you perfect strangers, could do for me what I could not do on my knees in front of the tabernacle. The safest place I'd ever been in my life. And of course, God would work it out that way. If I could go in there and get what I needed, why would I need you? And if I didn't need you, I'd miss the best part of what God has in store for me. And you know, and Kimberly didn't die. She lived, and she's wasn't retarded. She graduated with honors from Auburn University. Now, I always tell her, I think you can be retarded and graduate with honors from Auburn University. But just kidding. And she a year ago Christmas presented me with my first granddaughter, Haley Noel, and She's a wonderful, wonderful child, and she's been a wonderful child her whole life. And she's very, she's gotten well, and she's just wonderful. She's a school teacher and married to a dentist, and they live in Daphne, Alabama, and just wonderful kid. She's been wonderful all her life, and I'm glad God didn't kill her because her dad was sick. And that's the second step. You know, I was sober 5 weeks, and I walked into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and a man walked up to me, and he said, my name's Dick. What's your name? And I said, it's Keith. He said, is this the first time at this meeting? And I said, yes, sir. And he said, well, I'd like to get you a cup of coffee. I'd like to buy you a cup of coffee. And we went over, and he said, tell me, do you have a job? I said, well, I think I do. I said, I used to work at the university. I don't know if I still have it or not. And I said, I'll find out tomorrow. And he said, well, that's good. And he said, are you married? And I said, well, no. I said, she threw me out. And he said, well, you have any children? I said, I have two little girls, but I'm not allowed to see them. And he said, oh, what are their names? And I said, well, Kelly and Kimberly. And he said, you know, he said, I've never seen a father get sober and not see his children. And I, that's nice. I mean, you know, you're supposed to say nice things. I mean, you have a room full of phonies, and they say nice stuff, you know. And so I came back the next week, and I walked in the door, and this man, I remembered him, but I didn't know his name. He came over, and he said, remember me? My name's Dick. And I said, yeah. And he said, Keith, how's it going? I said, well, fine. He said, you stay sober all week? I said, yes, I did. He said, that's wonderful. He said, so did I. And he said, you still have your job at Georgetown? I said, yeah, yeah. He said, that's great. And then he said, how's Kelly and Kimberly? He remembered the names of my children. So you got to come to believe that something greater than you can restore you to sanity. To someone who was so fiercely isolated and so desperately alone that when I was living with my wife, there were nights I'd lay there knowing that she couldn't be my wife because I couldn't be that close to anybody. I felt like a perfect stranger. I was exactly where I was supposed to be. It's an amazing way to live if you're kind of new. God, it's an amazing way to live. And don't leave before you begin to feel and experience some of this stuff. Why don't we take a break, okay? A group of scientists got together and decided that man had come a long way and no longer needed God. So they picked one scientist to go and tell him that they were done with him. The scientist walked up to God and said, God, we've decided that we no longer need you. We're to the point where we can clone people and do many miraculous things. So why don't you just go on and get lost? God listened very patiently and kindly said to the man, very well, how about this? Let's say we have a man-making contest. To which the scientist replied, okay, great. But God added, now we're going to do it just like I did back in the old days with Adam. And the scientist said, sure, no problem. And he bent down and grabbed himself a handful of dirt. God looked at him and said, no, you have to get your own dirt. You know, I told you that I took my first drink in Pittsburgh. That's not entirely true, like most of my story. I had my first drink when I was at home. I was 5 years old. When I was five, I didn't go out a lot. So, and my brother was four. Now, I'm the second child, the eldest son in a family of 11 children, okay? I'm Irish. I won't tell you what church we went to. I'll let you guess, but it has something to do with bingo, okay? And I guess my mom was out, and Dad was watching us. She was either at the bingo or having a baby or something, and I think Dad thought it'd be sort of funny, so he decided that we're going to have a drink. Now, we rarely had alcohol around the house. Both of my parents had parents who, you know, if you wanted to go way out on a limb, you might diagnose as real alcoholics. And so they were very, very fearful about alcohol. And so we rarely had it around the house. But Dad had some beer in the refrigerator. And never forget this. He got a beer for me, and he got one for my brother, Dumb Denny. Denny's a year younger than I am. And I drank mine, and nothing happened. I mean, I was just fine, you know. Denny, on the other hand, was having a spiritual awakening. And he rolled around under the table and he was singing Mary Had a Little Lamb and other drinking songs. And when Dad kind of panicked and wrestled him to the ground and got his clothes off and put his jammies on him and took him up and put him in bed. And Dad was a little bit worried, and he said, "Don't tell your mother about this." And he said, "I'll take you to the movies on Saturday." Well, you know, when you're five, they don't negotiate much with you. So I was willing to go along, but then he wasn't here, and he was just having the best time. He was laughing and carrying on and singing and everything. And I'll never forget this. He stood up in his little crib, and he urinated on the floor. Yeah. And I remember thinking, you know, there's a kid who's powerless over alcohol and whose life has become unmanageable. And I like to tell that because, you know, not everybody makes it. You know, not everybody makes it. And Denny, you know, had a great start, and he just never developed. It was the saddest thing. You know, he went on and he did some strange things. I'll give you some examples. Denny went to one university. He had one major. He graduated in 4 years. He went to one graduate school. Right? Graduated top in his class. He's offered like 8 jobs. He took one. And 2 years ago, he retired as a vice president in a large international corporation. The strangest thing of all is he married one woman. Now, here's a guy who had the world in the palm of his hands when he was 4 years old, and he just let it slip through his fingers, you know. And I had to work at this thing. You know, I was 17 years old before I urinated on the floor for the first time. And, you know, alcohol, the second step is sort of the trap in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I love my former sponsor, Sandy B., who now lives down in Florida, puts it very, very well. He explained to me that Alcoholics Anonymous, it really misrepresents itself, okay? And he said, "You're going to discover that these people trick you." And I said, "All right, all right." He said, "For example," he said, "the second step, they say the hoop is so big anybody can jump through. They believe whatever you want to believe. There's room for everybody, right?" He said, "You get the 11th step, it's just God will, period." You go, "Wait a minute. You know, I thought the deal was I could believe whatever I wanted to. Sorry, it's too late. You know, you're enjoying life, you're happy," and on and on. "It's too late, you know. We've ruined it for you." And that's what the second step is. The second step is the thing that invites me in to this way of life. And, you know, I've come to realize that I'm hopeless. My life, I'm absolutely hopeless. That's what the first step tells me. The second step delivers even bad news, and it says I can't do it by myself. And so the third step invites me to make the decision to turn my will and life over to the care of God. Now this is a very interesting step because this thing was difficult for me. And of course it has to do with a lot of old ideas I had. And I was not a guy, I was really fortunate in Alcoholics Anonymous. My first sponsor, Dan, is a wonderful man. And he taught me how to be a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He took me on 12-step calls. He took me to prisons, to Howard Pavilion for the criminally insane, to the VA hospital. He really showed me. He took me on 12-step calls. He showed me what alcoholics do to carry the message. What we didn't do was a lot of step work. Now, my home group was a step group. And I thought what you did was you talked about the steps. That's what I thought you did. I thought you talked about the steps. So we talked about the steps. Now, I wasn't a big writer. I didn't do all that stuff, but we talked about the steps. And that combined with the fact that I was becoming very brilliant, very successful, and really climbing the ladder, you know, told me that I didn't have to mess around much with these steps. And I'm sober about 3.5 years and just absolutely insane. And my sponsor had left town, and so for the past year I've been sponsoring myself, which meant I had an idiot for a sponsor, so I was desperate, and I kept watching this man Sandy, and everybody said nice things about him, but what really attracted me to Sandy was the fact that he really enjoyed life. I mean, he'd been through a divorce and he'd lost everything, and he's happy as he could be. And everything was a joke. Everything was fun. Everything's part of God's plan. And that intrigued me. And he talked a lot about the steps. And I knew that I needed to do something. And And I've never been precocious. I mean, I just am not a quick study. I'm just not. I get good grades, but I'm not a quick study. And so I went to Sandy and I said, Sandy, I'd like to talk to you about sponsorship. He said, that's great. He said, get your running shoes and come over to my apartment tomorrow morning. It was Saturday morning. And I said, and I'm saying to myself, well, I don't happen to have any running shoes. Now, I got a few cartons of cigarettes, but I don't have any running shoes. But I couldn't tell him that, so I went and bought a pair of running shoes, and I rubbed them in the dirt so they look old. And just an incredible amount of honesty. My whole life has just sort of come natural to me. And so I went over, and we put on our running shoes, and we proceed to run. And we're running along, and, you know, I've smoked 4 packs of cigarettes a day, so I got to the point in a hurry, and I said to him, I said, would you consider sponsoring me? We're running along, and he said, you're having a difficult time, aren't you? I said, I'm having a really difficult time. And he said, well, tell me. He said, do you believe in God? That's an interesting question to ask a guy, you know? And I mean, I like 80% believed. You know, when I got my way, 90%, you know. But I wasn't sure. I had doubt. And I thought, now, nobody told me this, but I thought doubt meant you didn't have any faith. I now know that doubt's an element of faith. That to doubt the existence of God is an element of faith. You know? And that, you know, if you don't doubt, you don't need faith, do you? Because then it's certainty. But I didn't understand that. And I thought about it, and I instinctively knew that he was asking me a question that was critically important to my life. And I wanted to be absolutely honest. And I said to him, I don't think I do. And he looked at me, he was very sad, and he says, that's too bad, that means you're probably going to die. And I stopped running, and he kept running. And I thought for a minute, and I caught up with him. And I said, you know, I'm willing to go home and reconsider my position. And he said, you know, if you'll reconsider your position, you can live. And that's the third step. The third step is being willing to reconsider my position when it comes to God. And, you know, a lot of unlearning had to happen for me. I mean, I had come to blame God for what had happened in my life. I'd ask him, don't let him arrest me. They'd arrest me anyway. You know, and I mean, I had tried a lot of stuff with God. And you know, so I had a lot of doubts here, and I had to do a lot of unlearning. I had a lot of old ideas about God. And I, you know, it, I always get a kick out of people who describe themselves as recovering Catholics or recovering Baptists or this or that. I mean, the truth of the matter is that I never gave that stuff a chance. I never gave it a chance. You know, when I went to do my 8-step work with my brothers and sisters and things, I mean, they had an entirely different view of God. Entirely different view of nuns. I remember I went to make my amends to Dumb Denny, and somehow the nuns came up. And I was, you know, I had my spiel already. I said, yeah, yeah. I said, they used to beat my knuckles with a ruler, and they used to use a centimeter side on me. You know, it had to be worse for me than everybody else. And Denny said, you know, I seem to remember that happening a couple times. He said, but most of all, he said, I remember a bunch of dedicated women who gave their whole lives to teach little kids. That's, well, that's one way to look at it, you know. And, you know, and it just seemed to me that I never looked at it that way, you know. I always looked at it, and the book says that my problem is I'm selfish and I'm self-centered. And that was my view of life. And the third step says that I must reconsider my view of life. That my problem is that my ideas are old. You know, after I was sober, I was lucky enough to be granted a scholarship in where I worked. And so I worked full-time, I went to school full-time, and I went to 10 AA meetings a week. And every once in a while I slept. And I loved it. I was just sort of crazy. And I studied, I went back and I took a degree in philosophy and theology. Now it sounds boring, but it really, and I was very excited. I could study anything I wanted to, and that's what I wanted to study. And my sponsor told me, being sober meant you did what you wanted to do. That you didn't have to worry about what was practical. You do what your heart told you to do, and that's what my heart told me to do. And I went back and studied it. And one of the philosophers I studied was a guy named Hegel. And Hegel talked about something called the dialectical. And I like to think of that in terms of the third step. What the dialectical says, in essence, is that I have an idea or a thesis. And it's an old idea. Okay. For example, An old idea might be, I can do it alone. That's an old idea I had. And it's funny. I used to say to people, the Marine Corps taught me to rely on myself and do it alone. The Marine Corps never taught that. I learned that in a bar in Malta. You know, the Marine Corps taught me to be part of a team and to on and a fire squad and on and on and on and on. I mean, it never taught me to do it on my own. That was my interpretation of what Smedley Butler said or the Marine Corps said, okay? That was never the Marine Corps' interpretation. And so you got this old idea, you got to do it alone, right? And that's the thesis, that's the old idea. And along comes this new idea. It's entirely opposite of the old idea. You know, I need people. Boom! You know, it's a revolutionary thing, and there's always violence. Hegel says that when an old idea and a new idea collide, when the thesis and the antithesis collide, there's always violence. And there is. I go, no, that's not right. You know, I sit in that chair, I go, blah, 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 you know, and growl and all this stuff, and I go, I say the Lord's Prayer, and I got to hold hands with those weirdos, and blah, blah. And everything was conflict with me, okay? Everything was conflict. Now, you know what I was afraid of? A roommate of mine said to me one time, he said, you know, he said, they're brainwashing you. And I remember thinking, thank God, if anybody's brain needs washing, it's mine. I knew that much, okay? But I didn't want, you know, you weren't going to tell me how to live my life. I mean, what kind of guy would I be then? I mean, I'd spent all my life telling you nobody's going to tell me how to live my life. I mean, I did it my way. I did it on Skid Row, but by damn, I did it my way. And so now you're going to, you know, so there's got to be all this conflict going on. And it was conflict. And so I was afraid that you would change me. Isn't that crazy? And then I finally, Hegel said, well, you can't change somebody, you know. And so if you're kind of new here, don't worry, you know, you'll hear these concepts and this and that, but nobody wants to change you. What'll happen is you'll have your old idea, a new idea will come along, it'll cause violence, you'll disagree with it and everything. And then what comes out of that isn't the old idea or the new idea, it's a combination of them banging into one another. It's called a synthesis. You know? And that's why we keep coming back. And we keep hearing the same thing. But every time we hear it, it's different because we're different people every time we hear it. And pretty soon, those dumb sayings that they hang on walls become keys to whole processes of thought. You know, think, think, think. You know, what a wonderful thing. When I see that or hear that, a million things run through my mind. Things I've learned in the last 26 and a half years about thinking through a drink, about, you know, thinking before I open my mouth, acting, not reacting. All the things I've been taught are all tied together in that little think, think, think. And each one of those things I learned was always a revolutionary new idea. It was always an antithesis. Okay? And so what happens is I get changed. You don't change me. You present me with a new idea, and I get changed. And it's an incredible and an amazing phenomenon. So I never become a drone. I never become all the things I thought I'd become if I joined anything. I never joined anything. I remember even when I was in the service, a lieutenant said to me, he said, Lewis, you did a wonderful job. And I said, well, I just like working for you, Lieutenant. He said, don't kid you or me. He said, you don't work for anybody. He said, you do twice as much as you have to just so you don't have to work for anybody. And it was true. It was true. Okay? I was that isolated. But Alcoholics Anonymous works great for a guy like me because the book says you don't have to believe anything. All you have to do is show up. You have to show up, and I'm asked to decide what it is I believe. It's an interesting thing, isn't it? You decide what it is you believe because what we believe is different. And you're going to hear what we believe, and since it's different, usually the opposite of what you believe, you're going to be changed. So you believe what you want to believe. You bet your ass I'm going to believe what I want to believe. Okay, you believe that so that we can change you. Now, if you don't believe what you believe, we can't change you. So it's critical for you to have an opinion. It's crazy, but it works. It really works. And a lot of that has to do with the third step. The third step really is where I make a decision to turn my will and life over to the care of God. Okay? And what that means is that I'm going to determine what it is I believe. You know, I had never defined my life and my will. I had never done it. My will and my life belonged to alcohol. It told me when to drink. It told me what to think. It told me what to do. He told me how to act. You know, I drank in some of the finest places in the world, and I drank in bootleg joints on 14th Street. And I could make myself fit wherever it was, because I'd figure out what it is I was supposed to say, what it is I was supposed to do, and I'd fit. You tell me to Alcoholics, because you say, you come to Alcoholics Anonymous, you got to take a stand. You got to say, so I'll say something like, I don't believe in God. They said, that's great. If you don't believe in God, and you really hang on to that, you can believe in God. You have to, because we'll confront you with reality, and one day you'll believe in God. You'll get to the point where you'll think you invented the concept. And it's all because we begin by deciding we're not going to believe in God. I'll do it my way. Great! We love people who do it their way. Because if you decide to do it your way, when we present you with our ideas, which are different than your ideas, you end up changing. Huh? Yeah, now you got it. That's right. It's just an amazing process. It really is. You know, and the third step is a wonderful, wonderful step. And it's a process, you know, but it's also an event. I was out in California not long ago, and I guess it's been a couple of years now. You know, when you're around long enough, not long ago, can any be way, 5-6 years ago? You know? But there was a girl there, and she was carrying on about something and sort of whining about it, and she was really kind of desperate. I said, come on. So we took the book, and we went in. And I said, get on your knees. She said, well, I said, get on your knees. And I gave her the book. I said, read it. She said, I've been in AA for 10 years. I said, I know. Now we're going to take the third step. You know? She had thought she had taken it. But I confronted her with some new reality, and she took it. And of course, she had taken it. It was time to do it again. You know, she had gone that far out, and now it was time to reconfirm. And what we reconfirm is that God loves us, and that there's a special plan with my name on it, and that God watches every breath I take and every step I take, and He counted every hair on my head, and He carved me in the palm of His hand, and He knit me in my mother's womb, and all those things I've learned as a result of being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what the third step says to me is, yeah, that's right, that's what I believe. Sure it is. And the third step defines for me what I believe so that I can be changed. Let's see. I believe this, I'll go to the grave with this. Good. Tomorrow you'll believe something different. If you will define this, tomorrow you'll believe something different. And that's the magnificence of this whole deal. You know, and that's a great thing about being wrong. You know, it's a great gift. If you're kind of new, I was given it. Let me warn you, okay? I hate to do this, but it's only fair. Maggie's here. There's some old-timers here, okay? And I'm going to caution you about old-timers, okay? Come to the meditation, do that stuff. But for God's sake, stay away from old-timers, okay? They are not nice people. They aren't, you know. And I'll tell you this. Take this from me, okay? Tell you some stuff, okay? They say things like they need to go to meetings. They don't need to go to meetings. The only reason they go to meetings is the only enjoyment they get out of life is watching you and me suffer. Isn't that true? If you don't believe me, after the meeting, go over and tell Maggie a problem. The first thing she'll do is laugh. You know? That's what old-timers do. They laugh when you tell them a problem. And if you really want to make their day, tell them a problem about sex. They love problems about sex. You know? It's always the same thing, right? No sex, right? They're not having sex anymore, and they don't want us to have sex either. That's okay. Well, I used to go to this old-timer, you know, and I hung with a group of guys who was sort of the problem of the month group, you know. We had it all figured out that there's a problem someplace, and we misunderstood Alcoholics Anonymous, how it worked. We thought that Alcoholics Anonymous was a process of figuring out problems, you know. And you had to figure it, and if you didn't figure out the problem, a big hand came down and made you drink. And so once you recognized the problem, the clock was running, and you had to get an answer. And so we used to go to this old-timer, and he loved picking on me, you know. And like I said, when I came to AA, I was impotent. And, I mean, I sat on that one for a little while. Not literally, but you know, I didn't tell anybody about that. So finally, I didn't want to tell my sponsor, because, I mean, would you want to sponsor a guy who's impotent? Think about it. So I needed to be perfect for my sponsor. So I went to this old-timer. And I said to him, he said, I'm beating around the bush, and finally he said, what's the problem? I said, all right, I'm impotent. And he goes, ah! He said, a lot of us had that trouble. He said, it'll go away. I said, when? I thought it was important, you know. He said, what, you got a full social calendar? You know. So I went through them one time with this problem. I can't remember the problem. It was, you might have remembered, it was July of 1973. Terrible problem. July 1973. I can't remember what it was, but it was a very serious problem. I mean, it had to be serious because I went to this old timer, and he, all he did was abuse me. And I went to him, and I said, I got this problem and all this stuff. And he said, Keith, I'll tell you what I want you to do. I said, anything. I'm honest, willing, and open-minded. He said, yeah, I know. He said, so I want you to go home, and he said, I want you to borrow lipstick from one of the girls in the program. He said, now, I don't want you doing anything else for the girls in the program. He said, oh, that's right, you can't. You know. He said, I want you to borrow some lipstick from one of the girls in the program, and I want you to write on your mirror, Keith, you are wrong. I said, I can't do that. You see, my problem is I have a poor self-image, and I need to be affirmed. Don't ever talk that way to an old-timer. They have never read any of those books. And so I bought a tube of lipstick. I didn't want to owe anything to anybody, especially a woman, right, guys? So I bought a tube of lipstick, and I went home and I wrote on a mirror, Keith, you were wrong. And I knew you're nuts. I mean, I said, these people are out of their mind. What's this got to do with anything? And I threw the rest of the toothpaste or the lipstick in a trash can, and I went off to bed. And it was a normal night. A normal night for me at 60 days was I'd lay down and close my eyes, and for the first time that day, my mind woke up. And it took off. You know what I mean? And it's talking to me. You're never going to make it. You'll be alone the rest of your life. What difference does it make? You're infinite. On and on and on, you know. And it's just awful, you know. And finally, in the middle of the night, I drift off to sleep. And then the leg cramps would set in. Remember the leg cramps? Oh, God. I'd jump up and down beside the bed. The legs hurt so bad. And I lay back down. My mind would still be going in. 15 minutes before I had to get up, I go sound asleep. Remember that? Woo, sound asleep. And it'd take 3 alarm clocks to wake me up. You know, and if my mind's still working, you're going to go to work today, and they're going to find out you don't know how to do your job, and they're going to fire you. Doesn't matter because you're hopelessly in debt. You're going to live in Skid Row the rest of your life, but that's what you deserve, you bum. And, you know, just the usual stuff. And I went out and I started coughing. I just wanted to die. I wanted to jump in a garbage disposal, but it didn't work. And I went in the bathroom and I looked on the mirror and said, Keith, you're wrong. I said, well, thank God, because if I'm right, I'm in a hell of a lot of trouble. And I want you to know that the great gift of Alcoholics Anonymous is being wrong. The more stuff I can be wrong about, the happier my life is. It's an amazing phenomenon. And yet I thought just the opposite. I so desperately needed to be right that I used to change the argument to be right. If it was going badly and I started to suspect that I might be wrong, I changed the argument. And you know, and my poor ex-wife would just stop arguing. She would just stop arguing. And I'll tell you how vicious women can be, guys. This is vicious. I got everything I own in 2 suitcases and I'm headed down the steps. And my wife said, and one more thing. If you don't mind a suggestion, don't turn around. Because she's not going to say something like, you were the greatest lover I ever had. That is not what she's going to say. She said, one more thing. And I said, what's that? And she said, all those times when I stopped arguing with you, because you weren't right, I just didn't want to argue with you. You were still wrong. And I thought, how low can you go? You know, I mean, you know. Because I had this old idea that if you were wrong enough times, you had to leave the earth. I don't know why I thought that. You know, that somehow they'd say, well, that's it. You're out of here. And what we know about being sober is the more I can be wrong, the freer I get. Think about it. What if we'd been right? What if we were right about the world? What if we were right about men or we were right about women? What if we were right about God? Think about that. If I'd been right about God, I'd still be trying to dodge him. So the key to this whole deal is the willingness to be wrong. And to the degree that I can be wrong, to that degree I can be free. Free of all my old ideas, and that's what always bound me. You know, Bill says that the problem is lodged in the mind as well as in the body. And my mind was filled with a bunch of old ideas, a bunch of rules that never worked. Stuff that loving, well-meaning people passed on to me, and then I distorted even more. My saintly mother used to say, if there isn't some jealousy, then there's no love. And of course that's wrong. Of course that's wrong. If there's fear and insecurity, then there's jealousy. But jealousy has nothing to do with love. Lack of jealousy has nothing to do with love. Jealousy has to do with how I feel about myself and what I think of myself. And we'll talk about that when we get into the later steps. But I had to be wrong about all these things in order to be free. And that's what the third step promises me. You know, and I love the third step prayer on page 63 in the big book, you know. And you know what I love about it? It's just the way an alcoholic would do it. You finish the prayer, then what does it say? We thought well about it before taking this step. Well, it's too late. We just finished it, you know. And that's what I tell you. AA will do it to you every time. They really will. They'll trick you every time, you know. Many of us said to our Maker as we understood Him, God, I offer myself to Thee to build with me and do with me as Thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do Thy will. Take away my difficulties that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of Thy power, Thy love, and Thy way of life. May I do Thy will always. Period. End quotation. Okay. Exclamation point. Then, we thought well before taking this step, making sure we were ready, huh? That we could at last utterly abandon ourselves Him. Wait just a minute, you know. And of course, that's the decision that we make. And we do think well about it. You know, when I'm working with guys I sponsor, I mean, we talk a lot about this. We talk a lot about it. We at last utterly abandon ourselves to Him. Let's try it for 5 minutes. Let's for 5 minutes try to utterly abandon ourselves to Him. I'd say to them, what's your concept of God? And they might say, well, a loving Father. Sounds good. And I say, well, what would a loving Father want for you right now? And he said, I don't know what. I said, he'd want you to feel guilty and to hate yourself. And to be fearful. That's what a loving Father would want. No, he wouldn't. Do you hate yourself? Yeah. Are you fearful? Yeah. Then you're not yet ready to utterly abandon yourself to Him. Because that isn't what He'd want for you. And we talk about these things, the guys that I work with. We talk about these things. We talk about the nature of God. I don't know. I wouldn't want to presume to know what Bill and all the old-timers were thinking. But I think God is, I understand Him. People always say, well, I'll never understand God. Well, of course not. I mean, my finite mind will never, maybe one day I will, but on this earth, my finite mind will never understand the infinite Him. The great I am, it'll never happen, of course. But what I can know is something of the nature of God. I remember when I was able to see my little girls, they came over, and I lived in that basement apartment in a rough part of Washington, D.C. for 2.5 years sober. And I painted it, and I put curtains up, and I made it a comfortable place where I left. And it was just a tiny little place. And the kids would come over, Kelly and Kimberly. And I remember in the fall of the first year I was sober, I bought them coats. I saved my money, and they were $12.50 a piece, and they were great coats. They just loved them, and I had a sofa that opened up into a bed, and I'd put them in that, and then I'd take the cushions and wrap a sheet around, make a bed out, and lay down on the floor, and I'd just watch them, and they made me hang their little coats on the back of the chair, so when they woke up, they could see them. And I was thinking about this. I had talked to an old timer every once. I'd slip up and talk to one of them, and he had begun the process. He'd had me begin the process of thinking of the nature of God, and he said, "Think of God as Creator. Think of God as Father. Think of God as Protector." And he gave me a whole list of things, and I was thinking of God as Father, and I was these kids' father, and God, I loved them. Gee, I loved them. And I remember laying there, and I thought, you know, they loved those coats. And I thought, what if tomorrow morning they got up and they came and said, Daddy, we want you to take these coats back. We don't deserve them. It would break my heart. And yet my whole life, that's precisely the way I treated God. I gave Him back, or refused, everything He gave me. You know, He gave me peace of mind, and I opted for fear and conflict. You know, He gave me loving parents, and my job was to be ashamed of our poverty and to see what was wrong with them and to determine why I'd been cheated. You know, He gave me a father who spent time with me every day that I let him. And I chose to see my father's dirty fingernails and the slivers of steel in his fingers from the mill and the smell of oil and cigars.